All right, this is not a normal thing, by the way. I did, in the email, I mentioned the fact that I do want to have consults, and it can be either with your dogs or with somebody else's dog that you might know. And if so, you just let me know. But they're not going to be for the first 3 weeks. It'll be in the last 3 weeks. Okay. All right. Yeah. You're going to leave. I know. You're really bored, and you're going to leave. And yeah. All right. We'll see you next week.
All right. See you next week.
Say hi to the dog, the Delphi dog.
Okay, I will.
Okay, so we're going to talk about flight distance. Flight distance is something that you, whether you know it or not, see all the time. I see it all the time. It is so critical to whether or not a dog can like you or will dislike you or will be afraid of you or whatever, that it is, you know, if you don't learn anything else from this week, learn about flight distance because it is just so important. So flight distance is the amount of space an animal needs in order to feel safe. We also have our own flight distance. If you look at a group of people, if you look at your chairs, the chairs were all put in at certain places, but you probably moved them a little bit further away when you sat down. That's to accommodate your own flight distance. Some people have a much bigger flight distance than others, so it's not all the same, but the average for people is 44 inches, which is kind of an interesting thing. So if I go up to you and I shake your hand like so, we're going to be about 44 inches apart, depending on the length of our arms and all that kind of stuff. You want to stand up for me? So if I, and then put your knee down. Okay, great. So if I go up to you like this, and I do a trunk handshake, what have I just done? I have so invaded your face. Don't you feel awkward? And if you're a big guy and you do it, then you stand over and you're truly invading space. So if you ever want to know, thank you so much. If you ever want to know why dogs are afraid of men, I've just told you.
But that's cultural too.
No, it's not.
When I was in Europe, wherever I was sitting on airplanes, they were totally fine with clenching elbows like this.
Who's they?
The people on either side of me were Europeans. I don't know what other countries they were from. But it happened multiple times where, you know, I'm sitting in the middle and I got my little space and I got my, and I'm trying not to even touch
everybody.
Because they're, and if I'm like, they were totally comfortable with pulling over.
We bet that some really nice people. It's never happened to me. But also, when you're talking about an airplane or certain cultures, what certain cultures, and it actually brings up a really good point, what certain cultures will use is they'll use eye space instead of face space. So if you're sitting really close, they won't do eye contact. And so they just turn their head very slightly away, and that will cause them to increase the space. Now, the Japanese culture uses that all the time. They're just taking space like this. So I used to speak all the time at the Animal Care Conference for California's shelter services people. And there was this absolutely spectacular speaker there once who was talking about how to interpret, he's a cop, he didn't do anything with dogs, but he's talking about the use of space when dealing with criminals because of their different space needs that they might have or whatever. But it is fascinating to actually, you know, when you meet people, to see how long eye contact occurs, to see how far they stretch out their arm. All those kinds of things will indicate how much space they need. So there's, you know, different people have different amount of spaces they need, but we all need this bubble. We all have a bubble. Is it a big bubble or is it a little bubble? So we all have it. In the case of animals, all animals, the more fearful they are, the more space they need. So think about a sparrow sitting on the ground, you know, pecking at food or whatever, and they're probably, 10 feet away? That would probably be average. If you take a step towards that sparrow, what's it going to do? It's going to take another 10 steps back. It's just going to go back far enough to continuously keep the amount of space it needs. And it's flight distance. It needs that amount of flight distance in order to get away. So they're pretty much assessing that all the time. So if you were to see a coyote and an antelope, the antelope is going to be a certain distance away from the coyote. Now, if the coyote is hungry and then showing signs of predatory behavior, the antelope is going to be further away from the coyote or the deer or whatever. Whereas if the coyote looks like it's satiated, then the deer will be closer. So it's not only the amount of space they need, but how much they suss it up. And this, of course, is the reason for an eye stalk to begin with, right? Because they're coming in close to, they're getting as close, they're invading this personal space of the other animal, so they're close enough so that when they commit to actually attacking, that then they have a pretty good chance of actually getting the animal. So space is really important. So if you're dealing with one of these feral animals that we were talking about before, the village dogs, the amount of space they need, you could see the little black dog, Bindi, how much space she needed. She needed to be all the way around the other side of her owner, and she was using her owner to make her safe. But if it were just me and her in there, she would have been taking as much space as she could as well. And then what they do is they'll get all the way back and then they turn their head like this. So you work in a shelter environment, you're going to see this all the time. The dogs go back, and then they turn their head, which is increasing the space between you and them. So if you're a dog trainer and you don't know what you're doing, you will decrease that space too rapidly and you'll probably cause issues. And if you're a normal person and you go, oh my God, it's a little white fluffy dog. I want a little white fluffy dog. And then all of a sudden you put your hands down there and the little white fluffy dog bites you. You just invaded the dog's space. Where is Aspen? Aspen has some interesting space issues. Aspen? Hi, can I?
Oh, look at that, you did it!
Usually, when I do that, she starts dancing away. She has like this much space she needs. Good girl, you're such a clever girl. Uh-huh. And then did they get her?
They both kind of stand out for a while.
Yeah. And it's a small dog?
She's 31.
Okay. I could try you a quick fix on it. It works mostly with small dogs, but even works with larger dogs, is teach them to go up on something. So our dogs go up on an ottoman. They get up on the ottoman to get dressed. So they'll go up on an ottoman, I say, get dressed, and I put their harness on, they get a treat. But what you've done is you've actually increased their height. Because that goes along with space, right? The higher an animal is, the more confident they are. And which is really interesting. If you are in a shelter environment and you give the dogs something to sit on, you're increasing their power. Somebody I was talking to last night, with a behavior problem, the dog is biting all of her roommates, and she's got 10 of them, which is not a good idea. But one of the questions I asked was whether or not the dog slept on her bed, and she said yes. And I'm like, okay, height equals power in the dog. I don't have a problem with dogs sleeping on beds. She doesn't sleep on our bed, but our Chihuahua does. So I don't have a problem with that. But in this case, because height equals power in a dog's mind, sometimes with some dogs, not all dogs by any means, I recommended that you get the dog off the bed. So this space, this whole space, so try it. Yeah, try it.
She's better with me. Yeah.
No, but if you do it, then and she does it with you and him, she'll start getting a little bit more, and so you won't have that everyday frustration. Yeah, but as soon as he reaches down. So can you imagine if she jumps up on something, then they're right here? It's just going to be way easier, particularly if you give a treat, right, and just put the thing on. Well, get something that's really tasty, you know. Because many dogs won't go for, and I understand that, because our Chihuahua, you know, the It could be pète de foie gras. It doesn't matter. And if she's in a delicate state,
she gets nervous.
She's not going to take it. But if you start doing it, she'll go, oh, okay, this is good. I get to have my cake and eat it too. Then I get to go for a walk. And then your husband starts doing it as well.
But
yeah, hard to get her ready to go. Yeah. Or you put the harness on. But I would actually recommend that you teach a little. We call it go rock because we do it all the time. Give that a shot. See if it works, and get back to me. And if it doesn't, we can do something else. A lot of times tricks help too, but honestly, this one helped us more than anything else. I've done tons of pictures of all three little dogs trying to get onto the ottoman at the same time, so that they can all get their harnesses on. So it's very useful. And as a matter of fact, my daughter was the one who introduced it to me because she did it. She's got this little dog who was, he leaps onto top of things. And I thought, wow, that's good for my back. And then since then, I've realized that it's not just good for my back, it's good for them. They really get it.
Yeah, I've been sitting on the stairs. Well, just sit down on the stairs.
Yeah. A place is really good. I have one client with a little white fluffy dog. And they put their dog when people come into the house, they have him go up on the ottoman so that he doesn't jump all over them. So he sits there like this and goes, hello, hello. He's a Mr. Social. He's not fearful at all. So this whole thing about flight distance then, if you're dealing with a fearful dog and you intrude upon their bubble, then you're causing them to become more fearful, which in turn will send them into a state where they cannot learn. So whenever you're trying to work with a dog, you're always trying to put them in a position where they can learn, right? They need to be relaxed enough to learn. So if you're invading their space, say you put them on a leash and then you hold the leash and keep on going up to them, you may be able to get to them, but they are going to be, they're not going to be able to be receptive to whatever you're trying to teach them. So veterinarians have a horrible time because they not only have to go inside the animal space, but they also have to do something that's invasive. And the dog doesn't know they're being helped. The dog, as far as the dog is concerned, this is somebody who's doing something really awful. So if I were teaching at a vet hospital, I would be having people, I would probably set up exam rooms differently. I would set up exam rooms so the dog would come in and sit up on something first so that the vet could come and do some parallel, just chatting with them without looking at them for a little bit and then very slowly getting to know them. But then most vets have to do something in a 15 to 20 minute period of time. And that is, not conducive to a lot of trust on the part of the dog.
Dogs over a longer period of time where the owner will say, oh, they may have been abused.
Yes.
And then I have to sit there and then I find out that the dog is completely scared and will not approach until like a day has passed and then I can leash him. But if I'm on the trail like this morning, I was with three dogs and we ran into a dog with one of those invisible leashes, kind of like really thin.
Uh-huh.
And she said it was okay for them to approach her dog, but he was just scared. I stayed a certain distance away, but what would you do in that situation if you wanted,
to make a friend of that dog?
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to do that. That's not something you can do really quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, the best thing to do is to actually go for a walk with the dog. Yeah, so you parallel walk with them.
It makes me feel happy when I can get them to the point where they can go with their owners
You're always looking to remember what I said about eye contact. If that's part of the personal space invasion and they want to turn their head away, it's called avoidance, right?
This one was looking at me.
That's fear then. Okay. If there was a gigantic, we're gonna talk a lot more about that, but if there's a gigantic spider crawling down right here.
I'm a
huge, absolutely enormous spider. Where would you all be looking? At the spider. That's fear.
Okay.
That's fear. This is avoidance. That's fear. really.
It's like an everyday like occurrence that wouldn't happen to any of us. And I just want to, you know, I love dogs and I just want to make it better.
Yeah, you want to make it nicer, but sometimes the nicest thing you can do for a dog is not pay attention to it.
I think that's the thing I've learned the most in this class of caring since December is leaving dogs alone. And how many people try. It's okay, you can have a dog, like, your raw dog really doesn't want me.
I kept walking. I said, let's go keep walking, whatever I say. But we paused and she was standing and the dog was just there.
Essentially, you let the dog approach you. If you approach the dog, then you're probably going to be invading space, especially if they come, if they try to avoid you at all. Not your dogs, you.
I didn't approach.
Yeah, see, you did fine. Yeah, you did fine if you didn't approach. I think that it's so hard on people with their egos. We think everybody should love us, particularly dogs. Yeah, they should all love us, but they don't. Some of them take a lot more time. And after you've been bitten two or three times, you realize that not all dogs really like you. You know, they sometimes will try to force you away. And, you know, one of my clients the other day said, what's the worst bite you ever got? And I'm like, okay, you want me to tell you what the worst bite I ever got was? All right. But I got one that was really kind of a space-oriented one. So it is apropos. Somebody had called because they had a Belgian black dog, so the Belgian Girondal, and he had bitten like four people, and so I was stupid. Remember how you said when you were, you know, you're doing things wrong? I was stupid. I was actually doing training at Marin Humane Society. I was a trainer. I had not started taking courses in behavior. I did not know what I was doing, and I went to their house and I did some obedience, and I'm like, well, this dog is really great, no problem at all, because I was doing obedience, and the dog knew about obedience. Knew all of his obedience cues. And then, and I was working actually for Marin Humane, but I went to the house because of something. I can't remember, maybe they were unable to come to us. And so then I went to get the check for Marin Humane. So, and then I reached my hand out. And she was standing, the dog and the owner were standing really close to each other. And when I reached my hand out, she nailed me. Nailed me through my hand. Right, all the way through my hand. And it hurt like bloody crazy. It was, and I got nauseated because it hit my bone. It was like, and I'm standing there with my hand like this going, everything's fine. And there was blood dripping down here. I didn't go to the hospital. But, you know, I had intruded on that dog's space because I was stupid. Because I had assumed that because the dog was obedient, it was also behaviorally sound. And obedience and behavior are two different things. So I think that was one of my very first lessons. It was a big one. And that, boy, did that hurt for a long time.
So then what did you do? Did you go back and say, yeah, your dog isn't safe? It does bite people?
Well, I was right there. So yeah, I said it wasn't safe. Because they were contemplating putting the dog down. Because when he bit, and he bit hard. And I don't think I've ever been bitten that hard. I've been bitten more dramatically, but never that hard before or since. So, but that was a definite space invasion. And it's something that is relevant for anybody who works with dogs, whether you're in daycare or whatever, because, you know, some of the things that you have to do when you're in daycare, like putting a dog in a crate, can be a space invasion. So, you know, there's just all kinds of things that you don't think of that we just think of as being part of what we do, and we don't mean anything by it. We're being nice. We're being wonderful. We're being human beings that take care of dogs, and the dog is thinking that you're some kind of evil creature and that you're going to do something and hurt them. And I think that's really important. Yeah.
And that is fabulous. And they know how to do it.
Yeah.
Are their parents really teaching
them? Well, actually, it's the schools. A lot of times there are some schools that are doing their, it's called the Kind Newspaper, which is about being kind to animals and being understanding of animals. It's actually really cool. Now, when you greet a dog, if you greet a dog by doing this, what are you doing? You're invading their space. You really are. So if you greet a dog, the best way to do it is to stand like this, avert your eyes slightly, and just kind of hang. And if I know I'm going to be dealing with a fearful dog and I go into their house, I'm going to sit down. I'm not going to sit down on the couch, however. Because if I sit down on a couch, that means the dog is, in order to see me, is going to come up like this. And so all of a sudden, now we've got that eye contact, that thing. And what I want to avoid is anything that makes the dog think that I am a threat. I don't want the dog to think I'm a wuss either. Because there are dogs that kind of come up and push you. Go, ha, ha, gotcha. So you have to kind of give this impression of being powerful but benign. So I will generally ask to sit at a table. Because if you sit at a table and you're looking at the table, the dog can come up from behind you or underneath you. And they'll sniff you. And the only time they bite people when they're down there is if somebody does this. You know, if somebody approaches like that. So it is, you know, these are all things that I learned slowly. bit by bit when I was working with different kinds of dogs in different situations. So, fight, flight, intend, befriend, those are reflexes. So you all know about fight, flight, right? That if an animal feels that they are distressed, in distress, or threatened, their choices are either to run away or to fight. But actually, there are probably a couple more choices. One of them is to freeze, and we see that mostly with dogs that are fearful. They will freeze, and that's a kind of like a, oh my God, what am I supposed to do next? So you'll see fight, you know, freeze, then fight or flight. That's very common. One of my colleagues says it's fight, flight, or frenzy, because there are some dogs that almost go hysterical when they're. And then the one that I like is fight, flight, or tend, befriend. And essentially, again, these are choices the dog is faced with when they're feeling stressed or they're feeling that they have to make a decision. And tend, befriend is what my old German Shepherd Strider used to do. If he felt that he was, and this is what I wished all dogs do, if he felt that he was being threatened by something, he started to play with it. He'd actually toss his head, and then he'd go, ah, I'm not a threat, everything is cool, we're all groovy. And you'll see, I think I've got some videos of him doing that, as he would tend to try to diffuse any tension that was going on. So really good trainers have at least one dog that will do that. When Strider passed away, we had Boo. Now Boo's gone. Aspen's okay, but she has been intimidated by big dogs, so she's no longer great with big dogs. She's great with little dogs. So we need another big dog. So we're probably going to get an Aussie or an Aussie mix or something like that, because a good stable one, you know. So in most cases, the larger the animal, the less they will have a tendency towards flight. The more they will have a tendency towards freeze or fight. And think about cows. They don't really run that much. You can definitely stampede cows. But, you know, there's a place I walk that has cows, and I don't tend to walk there where there are cows because I'm afraid of cows because they do this. They do what I see dogs do, and I'm afraid of them, so they do this. I'm told it's just curiosity, but it's very intimidating. And, you know, and of course I'm walking with three little dogs, and I don't want my little dogs to get nailed, right? I want them to be happy. But they actually will, because they're so big and ponderous, they have very little fear. And so they will go towards the threat, whatever it might be. Compare that to deer. How close can you get to a deer in open space? Not very. I mean, if you live in Mill Valley or whatever, they're right in the middle of the street, but you go walking towards them and they're going to go flight and running off someplace else. So they've got a really high flight component, whereas cows and certainly a lot of predators have a bigger fight component. So in our world, we call it ADR or PDR, which is an active defense reflex or passive defense reflex. Do they have a tendency to go towards, or do they have a tendency to go away from whatever it is that is threatening them? Or do they have a tendency maybe to do tend, befriend? Not that Strider was a perfect dog. He wasn't. Didn't start off being a perfect dog. He ended up being a perfect dog, but he was cool. Your eyes twitching, okay. So dogs are predator and prey, so they are very complex. They have both things, you know, just like we do. We're predator, but we are also prey. So we have a full component of emotional responses to stress or to whatever is going on in our world. And I think that these are things that are really important to consider. Okay, so why did I shoot on to breeds here? Boing. Okay, what we're doing is kind of whipping through an overview, because I'm going to go come back to fight or flight as we get into kind of working on things or whatever. So now, remember in the very beginning we talked about we all want to know what this dog is, and people do DNA tests or what their dog is and whatnot. And I used to go up to people and say, you know, it's not really important. You got a little terrier mix, you got a little terrier mix. And I go, you know, we don't walk up to each other and say, are you Irish English or whatever? But now with 23andMe, maybe we do. I don't know. I'm not all that interested to find out what I am, but I certainly think that people want to know. But the AKC now recognizes 190 breeds of dog. I had to look this up, because every year there are more of them, right? So what happens is they can register a breed after they've, I think, been able to follow the pedigree for 3 generations. I think that's what it is. So there's a Bernard Picard, a miniature American Shepherd, a Lagotta Romagnola. Anybody know what any of these are? Miniature American Shepherd looks pretty much like it's going to be that one over there, right? These are all things that the AKC, and I'm prejudiced, so you have to remember that. AKC is just a registration form. They do not, if a dog is AKC, it does not mean they're a good dog or a bad dog. It just means they are registered. The AKC is a money-making institution. That is what they're there for. And they do not keep up anything like a responsibility to make sure that good dogs are bred and that good dogs are taken care of. They do not. So I have a horrible prejudice against them. Even though I have shown dogs in the past, I've had AKC dogs in the past, it's still not okay. So speaking of breeds, there are all these different breeds. Where do breeds come from? And this is one of the funny things that you get if you're a behaviorist or a trainer. People will bring up their dog and they'll go, what do you think he is? And I'll go, it's a, you know, medium-sized, long tail, trick ear, herding dog mix. Yeah. So we even tried to get that at the shelter. We tried to get, you know, just stop calling them breeds, but people really want breeds. So just think about this. If I have an Australian Shepherd and I mate this Australian Shepherd with a Bernese Mountain Dog, I'm going to have hairy puppies. So now I've got a Australian Shepherd Bernese Mountain Dog mix, and then you come up and you've got a Rhodesian Ridgeback that has mated with a German Shepherd. And now you have a Rhodesian Ridgeback German Shepherd mix, and now we take our two puppies and we have just mixed those puppies. How many breeds are in that pup? Yeah. So, do you think you're going to get puppies that all look like one or the other? No, they're all going to look totally different from one another and from their parents. So this is the silliness of trying to think of what a breed is. So they, you know, you get street dogs, or what breed are they? Formosan Mountain Dog. Okay, so if we stop breeding dogs as breeds, they'd start looking like a village dog, because that's the most efficient way to look. Short hair, prick ears, blah, 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 you know, all those things. And that would make it difficult for us to identify breeds. So, there's a dingo. What breed is this? It's a black and white meaning by them right now. Border Collie, Jack Russell Terrier. What do you think it is? It's not even a Borzoi. It's a silken windhound. So silken windhounds look like miniature Borzois. And, you know, I happen to know the breeder of this, so I know that that is that dog, you know, as an adult. But who would know? You get this dog into a shelter, and you go, and somebody says, what do you think it's going to look like? How much do you think it's going to weigh? I don't know. You go, okay, I don't think it's going to be very big. And a sunken one hound isn't going
to
be.
My dog came this dog to my shop, knocked up. She had among later 6 puppies. And she's 14 pounds, and now 9 years later, one is 35 pounds. They're all super hard, but she's like her guts, and so some have short legs, some have long legs, some are like, look like golden noodles, perfect golden noodles. But they range between 20 and 35 pounds.
And she could have had several different husbands.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because they can mate with several different males, which does not happen with cats. Doesn't happen with cats. If a cat mates twice, which they often do, the second mating overrides the first, and the cat actually resorbs the kittens and then has a litter of other of the new dad. But with dogs, they can actually have several dads in a litter for a litter.
So I'm talking to somebody in guide dogs, and they said it's really difficult, but they tried for 6 years to get multiple dads, and were able to get it twice.
Yeah, well, they tried. It probably just happens without, you know, how many people do you know are trying to have babies, and then how many just babies just happen, right? So yeah, it's because I've seen them. They must have been. Although you never know. You never know.
I was actually gonna do the genealogy.
Yeah, I have a great story about that. But wherever she went, she has 2 brothers. One of them is 35 pounds and one's 20 pounds, and she's 12. She's 12 pounds. So, you know, and her mama was about 12 pounds. But obviously daddy or daddies were much bigger. They're also pistols. Just, they put her to shame. Oh, she went into her crate. That's nice. Our newest dog, who is a very short-legged little spaniel corgi mix. That's what she looks like to us. She's really cute. When she runs, she kind of flops like a slipper. She's adorable. We took her to get her adopted and then went, oh. So that was our last foster puppy. And anyway, so I did her DNA. And her DNA came out as, I have it somewhere, but it came out as part Akita. She's 20 pounds. Okay. Part Akita, part Pitbull, part Spitz, and some Labrador. And I'm like, what? So I'm talking to one of my clients, and my client he's a geneticist. And he said, did your dog drink any water that other dogs drink? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, that guess whose DNA went into your dog's DNA test? So if you ever do one, because Luki is probably part Akita, part Pit. And God knows what some of the others come with. So, but anyway, just be careful with that. Okay, I think I'm going to... I hope I can do this and I don't mind. It's getting warm, right? Okay, so if you breed, if you overbreed, this is what you get. That's the royal family's noses. You know, that from that one to that one. But this is my family. So we all have I have 11 brothers and sisters. So this is, you know, we all have some similarities and many differences. And I think that's something that we all need to remember is that you will get, because you're going to get people who say, this dog is not at all like my old golden retriever. They are not clones. Even clones are probably not clones. So you have to remember that just because you have one dog that looks like this doesn't mean your next dog is going to look like that. So speaking of breeds, what, you know, types of dogs were definitely bred for certain things, right? So herding dogs were bred to herd. There's hunting and retrieving breeds. There's flock guards. Those are like the big white dogs, like Great Pyrenees and whatnot. Pest control. That's terriers. They're pest control. Protection. War. War dogs were very common up till. Well, actually, they're still used. But in the Roman times, they put those big spike collars on them. You know, the great big spike collars, and they had them run where horses were going. So they cut down the horses. But we still use war dogs for a variety of different things. So these are all different things that breeds are bred for. And this is really relevant because of what we're using them for now, which would probably be, you know, not. Most of the dogs that people get, they get because they look like something, not because they do something. And I think that's really, really important. So a lot of the breeds retain many of the characteristics that they had as when they were first being bred. But we now breed for looks rather than behavior, and we've really screwed things up. I think one of the biggest issues I've had recently are dogs like mini Aussies that people expect to act like little fluffy white dogs. But they don't. They act like mini Aussies, only they're high stress, high anxiety, and really nutcases. Mini Aussies are bred down Aussies, and they probably use Pomeranians to get them there. So they're really... They may have used Jacks as well. But you know they use something to get them down that small. But they bark a lot. They bark more than the big Aussies do. And they are... My latest bite, also this poor hand, same hand, always gets it. It's because I'm left-handed, but it bit me right here, and it was a mini Aussie. Actually, it's a toy Aussie. I mean, come on. So anyway, but we will. If we can get to it, I don't know if we're going to be able to, because I used to do a 40-hour thing. And this is 18 hours. We can talk about breeds, but right now is probably a good time to mention that you will have homework, and your homework, you have a final project, and your final project is to investigate a breed. Do a paper on a breed. It can be a breed that you own, it can be a breed that you just like, it can be a breed that you don't know anything about that you're fairly interested in doing. If you don't have very much time, a paragraph will do. If you have time and the inclination, you can do a whole PowerPoint. Totally up to you. This is just in the spirit of investigation rather than like anything for breeding purposes or whatever. But in the end, I'll put all of them together and put them in a book, and then you get an electronic copy of the book with your breeds in it, which is kind of fun to do. So, but it's fun because say you've always wanted to know about Rhodesian Ridgebacks and you don't know anything about them, then you can learn some stuff. What I don't like is if you just take one, you know, do copy and paste, if at all possible. But it's up to you. I mean, there's no way that I'm going to be able to monitor it. So it's just fun to do. We've had some really great ones, and so what I'll do is I'll put a sample on the web so you can see what I'm talking about, a couple samples. But it should be fun, and if you have any questions, just let me know. You will have one other piece of homework, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. Okay, so again, we're going to leave breeds for the time being and talk about domestication versus taming, because this is all about the ethology. So, and it does have a lot to do with these feral dogs that we've been talking about, the village dogs, because domestication is a very long process. It takes place over generations. And in the case of dogs and cats, it's something that they chose to do. They chose to be with us. We did not necessarily ask them to be with us. They are the only animals that do not need to be caged or held or have fences in order to stay with us. Who was talking about the dogs that just lie out in the middle of the street? Those dogs are just dogs. They chose where they live, and they live with you, and you are their family. You are their pack. Whereas if you didn't have any fences for horses, do you think they'd hang around? I doubt it. Even though they may love us and they may do well by us, they, you know, would probably prefer to be free. And think about this. For all of the fact that they domesticated us, dogs are the only animal that we not only tell them where to go to the bathroom, we tell them when to go to the bathroom. So they are our prisoners, but they're prisoners who domesticated themselves. It's really fascinating. In order for domestication to replicate or to continue, the process has to be replicated in each generation. So if I had a little dog and she had puppies, then I would need to handle those puppies, and then I would need to do some socialization with those puppies, or else the process of domestication would start to go backwards. They would still, being dogs, they would still want to be around people, but they would not necessarily want to be handled by people. And if it's a case of something that is a less domesticated, it's gonna be even more so. So feral animals are those in which the socialization process did not take place. Think of cats. You know, if you have a cat that people, you know, cats are more attached to their territory than they are to people in a lot of cases. So they'll hang around the house even though you move. So if nobody takes care of them, they become feral. And then they have to either look for food, you know, maybe somebody else feeds them, or maybe they find food kind of in other places. That next generation of kittens is going to be more feral, it's going to be feral. So unless that generation of kittens is handled, they will be pretty wild. The following generation of kittens will be totally wild. And you will probably not be able to domesticate those. So two to three generations down, you're gone. The domestication process is ended. Now you'll have to tame them. So if you get one of these kittens, you have to tame it. And taming is the process of helping one wild or feral animal acclimate to our society. It is not domestication. So if I had a wolf puppy, and I took this wolf puppy, and I taught this wolf puppy to be part of our family or whatever, that one wolf would be tamed. But that does not mean that he is actually domesticated, nor that he can extend his feeling of being safe to anybody else. So it's really, again, it's really important with our society that is doing all this stuff with even getting dogs from, like, farm dogs, from, you know, bringing them in from up in the farmlands and whatnot, and we get them here, and then we say, oh, you're part of a suburban life. And the dogs just, they can't handle it. And so we have to go through this process of taming to try to make them actually acclimate to our home and to our society. And it can be very difficult. And by the way, one of the essences of working with behavior is that you have to realize how much you fail. How you cannot help them all. Much of the time, I think my job is teaching people, helping people learn who their dog is. Helping people accept who their dog is and what they can do to help their dog, for sure. You know, there's always some behavior mod that goes in and whatnot. But a lot of it is, this is the dog you have. It's kind of like, you know, marriage. People say that women marry men in order to change them, and men marry women because they like the person that was, and nobody seems to realize that all this stuff is changing all the time. And the only consistent thing about behavior is that it always changes. It always changes. Yeah? Could you talk louder? Now I've got this in here.
With wolf hybrid?
Wolf hybrid? Oh yeah, they're you know, there's nothing stopping all those neural pathways from being created, and as the hormones kick in, and it's not just sexual hormones; these are all kinds of hormones kicking in at different levels on the dogs. As the dog matures, you will get different behaviors, lots of different behaviors. So it's always fun. And social maturation, which happens for a wolf hybrid, is probably going to happen somewhere around two and a half. You will get changes, substantial changes. For some dogs, little dogs, maturation happens at about a year, 9 months to a year. So they mature earlier, live longer. You know, the big ones mature later. Malamutes mature between 4 and 5. Yeah. So the big guys, they mature. And then Great Danes mature between 4 and 5 and then die at 7. You know, not all of them, luckily, but a lot of them. So if a dog or a cat does not have appropriate experiences during certain periods of time during brain growth, it is very difficult, if not impossible, to complete the process. Because you're trying to tame a semi-feral animal, and that's a big deal. Okay, I think we talked about neoteny. Remember I was talking about the infantile characteristics? So shortened muzzle, rounder eyes, rounded forehead, shorter legs, curly tail, floppy ears, softer fur, all those things are part of neotenizing, which are puppy, the look of a puppy. And that's one of the reasons why domestication actually occurs, because we've neotenized animals. But now we love a neotenized animal so much, that that's a Bernese Mountain Dog, you can see that, right? But look at these guys. These are fully neotenized animals. Do they look like adults or do they look like puppies? They look like puppies, yeah. Particularly the Chihuahua. But that is a fully adult Chihuahua. That is not a puppy. So what we have done, you know, in our wisdom is we have neotenized these animals and then we're surprised when they act like puppies. But they do, they act like puppies. And of course pugs act like puppies. So some of the characteristics of puppies with pugs is that they tend to be pretty social and they have terrible body language. They don't have a clue what they're saying to other dogs, and because they haven't learned it, because they never got out of puppyhood. So they don't have that full repertoire of behaviors that another adult dog would have, like a wolfy type dog, like a husky or whatever. And when we get into that, you'll really see it. Yeah, it's interesting. Nobody actually really knows how it happens. It just happens with our dogs. And of course, then if you really like that look, then you breed that look, and now you're going to get just going to be more and more. She says, "I don't want to be petted. I want cheese." Yeah, they do.
But he's got the round eyes.
Yeah, they look like puppies.
Ears and the curly tail and the soft fur, and he's very baby, you know, puppy looking.
Yeah. So we like that. So we tend to keep reading it, you know. And so you'll really see that. So some of the other things, I'm sure that I talk about this here.
Yes.
But there's a puppy look and a, you know. But this is important, and I may be jumping my own gun here. It may pop up again in a later slide. But if you look at the wolf's face, look how much you can see in that face. If he put his ears back, you could see it, right? And you would know that he was threatening you or he was afraid. If he stares at you with those eyes with that beautiful eyeliner around it, are you going to have any doubt at all what he's thinking of? Or if he does, you know, puts his mouth open and shows his gums and shows his all of his teeth, will there be any doubt in your eyes, mine? Now look at this dog. He can't show very much because his ears are floppy, his eyes are round, and they've got you know, eyebrows and eyelashes that go all the way down there. And so it's very hard for him. And even if he does a snarl, you're not going to be able to see it nearly as well. So one of the things that has happened in our breeding of dogs like this is that we've read out body language. And if you look at any of the more primitive dogs, like German Shepherds, Huskies, Malamutes, they all have this. You can see their eyes. You can see their mouths are usually outlined in black or in another color. Their ears are pricked, so you can see them. Name me another animal besides a dog. Name an animal in the wild that does, that has dropped ears. Da, 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 da. Anybody know of any? People have come up with elephants, but they don't. You can't say bunnies because bunnies are domesticated animals. You know, the flop-eared ones, the ones down here. Because nature made it so that if you have ears, you actually should hear out of them. So what are the problems with drop ears? That they can't hear, they get terrible infections. Awful infections.
Because sometimes my dog will be on the road, but his ears will go back so slightly.
Yeah, you can, it's really, really hard to read it. Yeah. There was a study that was done that was fascinating that said that dogs with drop ears and dock tails got into more fights at dog parks. Because the other dogs couldn't read their signals, you know? And if you look there are people who, you know, they get old English shepherd, and I'll go, you gotta pull that ear so they can see, you gotta pull that hair back. And they go, oh, but nature intended that. Now, how many wolves have you seen with something like that? If your daughter came home with bangs down here, would you say, can you see? You know, that you can't see if your bangs are too long. So it is, it's really fascinating, but I have fights with clients all the time. Can we just put a little bow up here? Just, you know, try to get this away from there. And, you know, you can't do anything about the drop ears. That's just gonna happen. But the drop ears are a side effect of neotenization because puppies have drop ears. Now the reason puppies have it is because their ears have to be sealed when they come down the birth canal, you know, so it's necessary. But then they go up and they perk up, but they don't necessarily in all different breeds. So this is a non-neotenized dog, and that is a neotenized dog. The shepherd, you can see, now he does not have, he'd be hard to read. In fact, black shepherds are really hard to read and scare people to death. Because they have the prick ears, so they look really wolfy, but at the same time, you can't read their faces very well unless they snarl. And if they snarl, you really can. So, you know, it is nature's best interest to have a lot of kind of outlining of important parts of the dog. Then here's Luke, right there. They're doing a go rock there, and there's Flocka looking like a bird, you know, a deer caught in a headlight. So neotenized behavioral characteristics, relatively high frequency of play, lower threshold for barking and other vocalizations. So they're gonna make a lot more noise and they're gonna make it more often. Lower frequency of aggressive behavior in young puppies. Puppies will be aggressive towards one another. One of the interesting things is if you get a litter of puppies and they'll start fighting each other. At right around 5 weeks, they start going, oh yeah, yeah. So they'll start fighting each other, and people go, oh my God, that's an aggressive dog, and you put them in with another litter of puppies, and it goes, oh, I'm good. So it's not really that they're aggressive, they're just fighting amongst themselves. Less fear of the unfamiliar or the novel. What happens at about 5 weeks of age in wolf puppies is that they start getting really afraid of novel environments, but it does not happen until a little bit later in our pups. Kind of interesting. And juveniles display less predatory behavior in dogs. So again, changes affecting in communication, which we just kind of talked about. Dropped or floppy ears, which may have less communication value. Variable tail length and carriage, also resulting in changes in communication. So if you have a long tail, you can say a lot with it. If you get a short, stumpy tail, you can't say very much at all. You have to count on their whole body, you know, the whole body wag that they'll get if they don't have a tail. But you can't see that in a dog. It's harder to see it in a dog with no tail. Yes, they are. It's a natural dock. It does happen, but it does not happen consistently with any breed. It's an aberration. Yeah, and if you breed two dogs that have that, if you're breeding two recessive genes, you're likely to get some really bad, really severe spinal cord problems. So you would not want to do that. It's kind of like breeding two Blue Merles together, you're gonna get issues if you do read two Grizz assets. Less consistent ability to piloerect. Now, piloerection is when the hackles go up all the way down the back of the dog. And so it is a sign not of aggression, it is a sign of arousal. It is a sign of, I'm ready, something's happening, I'm ready. You know, if you get the skin prickling on the back of your neck or whatever, it's alarm or whatever. And in German Shepherds, it is a constant way of living. They're always, their hackles all the time. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. It does not mean they're about to attack. It just means that they're getting aroused. They're ready for whatever may come. They're ready. But again, look at this dog and tell me if you can tell if he piloerects.
I don't think mine does.
No.
He doesn't hackle.
He can't. He does underneath that coat, but you can't see it. So you can't tell if a dog like this is really alarmed. It's really hard to tell if the neotenized dog is alarmed, is getting angry. I mean, there's just a lot that you can't tell. So when we're talking about body language, this becomes pretty problematic. You know, what is this dog doing? And so hopefully what you want is for them to be a little bit more in their actual movement. They're going to show a lot more. And many, if not most of them do, but it already puts them at a disadvantage because they just don't have the ability to do that.
Yeah, or
leave me alone. Yeah, so that's a really big one. Let's see. Oh, so what do our dogs need? Wait a second. That's clock in there. I think this one is. So this is all of our dogs getting ready to go for a walk. So they're all sitting. So it's a little Heather with the little short legs there. And that's Lukey. They're going, oh, how did I get here? Because when we got him, we had all big dogs, and now he's the last man standing. You know. But I think no, it's not. I thought I made this a. No, I didn't. This one, I put a little voice on her that says, "Why is my life so hard?" But these are things that the dogs need. So they need the basics. So this is what our dogs do all the time. They go and get up in trees and all that kind of stuff because it really keeps them very safe. So what dogs need is they need sleep, stimulation, exercise, food, and social interaction. Those are the things that they really need. And I think, yeah, so I'm just going to stop here, even though it's a little bit early, because we're going to get into all the things that they need and all that kind of stuff next week. So, does anybody have any questions about their own dog or somebody else's dog or whatever? No? Yes.
So the new dog, the American Indian dog, I think it's Husky. I don't know exactly what. But he's just like naturally scared of people. He loves dogs. He's always behind me. He doesn't want to interact with people. I'm just wondering, like,
what
are ways to get past that?
How old is he?
Huh? He's
7 months old, and what kind of dog?
American Indian dog.
American Indian dog. So what does that mean?
Just like they're sort of, so I got a cow dog, because they're so cool, because they're wild dogs. They're, they're reservoir-like, Native Americans back in the day, so really they're kind of like.
So they're pretty much village dogs.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so they're very much really a village dog. And he is fearful of people. He's good with other dogs, but he's fearful with people. And what have you been trying to do?
Just go to different places and just let him be, like people, let him sit like next to people. And I haven't really done too much treat training. My problem is I'm a dog walker, so I'm out on the trails, I don't see people.
And he goes with you?
Yeah, he's just like loves it. He runs in the hills, loves other dogs, likes a lot of the other dog walkers.
So once he gets to know somebody, he likes them.
Yeah.
Do you think he likes people with dogs, or does he like any people without dogs?
With dogs.
He likes people to be, he likes the inclusion of dogs in his. Yeah, well, that makes sense, because he, as far as he's concerned, he can trust dogs, and so if people are with dogs, he starts to think that they're kind of okay.
And because he's a puppy, I think people are just trying to pet him too much.
Okay, so you need to tell people they can't do it. Tell them he's sick.
Okay.
That works. Because if you say he's fearful, they go, oh, you know. So you have to say, I'm afraid he's got a strange anogenital disease. You know, so...
And
he just got bit by a skunk. No, you can't say that. You know, but you can say he's not feeling well, and I think that oftentimes will make people kind of back off a little bit because they're willing to give space to dogs that don't feel well, whereas they're not very willing if they think the dog is fearful, then they just think that they're the best thing that ever could have happened to that dog. And I would maybe do some treats. So what you can do is you can, you know, after he has successfully passed a person, you can even put a cue on it. You can go, oh, there comes a person. And it can be a really calm cue. And then as you go past, right after you've passed, you just give him a little treat. So what'll happen over a long period of time is he'll start going, oh, here comes a person. That means I get a treat afterwards. And I don't have to deal with them. I don't have to live with them. I don't have to do anything like that. All I need to do is just get past that person. So he'll want to get past, that's for sure. But at the same time, he'll start to draw a correlation between a person that's coming and something good that happens to him.
I had a really good walk path that was less than just a few people. Because I took him to Point Isabel and he lost it. He did not want to be there.
Nah, that's hard. Point Isabel is cool. I love Point Isabel because... We like to go and watch dogs. You know, that's what we like to do. But yeah, I would imagine for a dog like him, it probably would be, yeah, it'd be very difficult for him. He needs to feel, and you know, you seem like you're pretty on top of it. He needs to feel comfortable within himself. He needs to, if he's acting like he's nervous, then he can't meet anybody at all because it's not going to work. But if he is, then he can start to draw conclusions. Then maybe, you know, within a few months, he'll start wagging his tail slightly when he sees people. Whether or not he will actually want to meet them, maybe not. In a case like that, if he were my dog, I'd probably say, you don't need to meet anybody. You just need to be nice when you pass. And then if you get anything else, it's gravy. You know, then you're going, oh boy, look what we've got. He got social. And he should be able to get to know and like your friends.
Yeah, people who come to my house, it takes a little while, but
he warms up. Yeah, so the way they form their social attachments is like, it's you and him, you know, you, him, and the other dog that you've got in your family, and then he's going to slowly go, okay, and then at about 3, it'll be done. He's going to go, no, I'm not, nobody else, don't want anybody else. So it'll be hard for him, but he can expand it for a while. Okay. Anybody else?
Well, I have two dogs. Two of my dogs, my bully and Chihuahua. Chihuahua doesn't like people. Ah. Touching him sometimes. He's fearful of people. But it depends. Like, I took him to daycare this week, and I think he did pretty good without me in there with him.
So he did better when you were not there than he did when you were there?
Yeah. Because I've taken him to the vet, and the vet tried to put the vaccines on the back of his neck, and he got lashed out and tried to bite her. And he did the same thing 2 weeks ago.
How long have you had your Chihuahua?
A year.
Okay, and how old is he now?
Uh-huh.
How old is he now?
He's a year.
He's a year old. Oh, so you got him when he was really little?
Yeah, I found him in a box with his brother just on the road. So I don't know if
somebody threw him away.
Yeah. Yeah. They threw him away, and I don't know what happened to him before that. So,
you know, he might be a really good consult for later on down the road. It might be nice if you if he felt comfortable and you brought him here. Would that be something that he could do? Because he is. Remember, I talked about epigenetics a little bit. So that's kind of probably there's a strong epigenetic factor here. The dog is actually picking up on behaviors that his mom had to do in order to avoid danger. So, and he's a year old now, which means that we're not going to be completely successful, but you might be able to help. And there are some things that you can do. One of the first things is what I talked about earlier with teaching him to go up on top of things, because that helps immensely with dogs that have a lack of self-confidence, is to go up on top of things like couches or whatever. It just gives them more power, as long as strangers don't try to touch them when they're up there, because then they can get pretty darn snappy. But it does give them a good perch to look at the world with. So, but you know, we have like a minute left, so I don't think we can really address your issues, but it does sound like he's got some pretty serious fear. Yeah? Pretty serious fear. Okay, so yeah.
We have to wrap it up. We can wait. I just had another.
Do you think it's quick?
Oh, I can make it quick, yeah. Fast dog. Our dog, since our last dog died in December, Jeffrey was more outgoing. He's moved to a bit more shy. When my husband and I not talk politics in the house.
Do you guys get pissed off when you talk politics?
You know, we don't get pissed off. But we get our voices, both me and my husband, maybe go down, maybe an octave or two, but we're like, oh, God. Cecil will now cower. And
we'll start to tremble, and we don't fight. No, but your voices are going up, and so he thinks it's fighting.
Well, he might. It doesn't
want
to
be
like this.
You'd have to do it like this. I can't believe what's happened today. Yes, it's very hard to do that, yeah. Did you hear what that man did now? That wasn't the idea, but yeah.
It's a weird thing because it gets us all. We get into something and we can't talk.
Okay, so here's what that is. This is a really good topic. So this is what this is. It's not your tone of voice. It's the energy that you have that is causing him to do that. And you can make So it doesn't matter how loud it is. What matters is the amount of energy you are generating.
It's funny. You can go so far as like, okay, we're going to talk. Okay, let's ground. Take a few breaths. But then we must forget ourselves.
Well, of course you do.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I would. Yeah. I would.
We build that to you. It's almost like you know that he's like, oh, that.
When I cough, Flocker runs to the bedroom.
Yeah.
When I cough. When Trisha coughs, no problem. When I cough, she's gone.
I can't.
Yeah. So, yeah, you've got a really highly, highly sensitized dog. So you can try some, I mean, we can't talk about it too much but right now, but you can try some, and your dog's the big, he's a Caroline dog. So if you teach him that as soon as you want to talk to do something like that, you give him something really tasty and you put him in a crate or kennel or someplace where he can hide. That might be helpful so that you and your husband can vent. Just yes, I know. Yeah. Yes, there is. Yeah. The stress in America apparently is up like 80%.
You know, poor dog doesn't get it when we're like, we need to go for a walk without you.
Yeah.
Because that's our thing.
I would probably do what we talked about over here. You can actually do some counter conditioning. You can say, okay, when my intensity level goes up, you get to have something really good. Now, it may not work because he may go, no, thanks very much, but I know a bomb's going to be dropping shortly and I don't want to eat anything because I got to run away. Right? But this is such a good topic because energy is what makes the world go around. Not necessarily vocalization, level of voice, or anger, or it's the amount of energy. And if you've got a dog that explodes with other dogs and only some other dogs, that's probably it. Yeah, so energy is really, really important. So we will talk a lot more about that. So is this good?
Yes.
All right. I will see you next week, same time. And if anybody wants to stick around for my client, you're welcome to do so. Oh, and if you didn't sign in, sign in. Please.
Especially for that, I'm going to do something like that.